Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us today for this, the latest edition of the OIES podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the GAS programme at the Institute. And it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Martin Lambert, who's Senior Research Fellow of the OIS, and we're here to discuss the key messages that came out of his recent paper, Energy Transition in Japan and Implications for GAS. It was published by the Institute in November 2021. Just to timestamp this recording in this ever-changing market, we're recording this podcast on the morning London time of Wednesday, the 24th of November. Martin, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
David, thanks. It's great to be back.
Well, Martin, you know, can we perhaps start with kind of a basic question? You know, can you perhaps explain to our listeners what prompted you to research and publish this paper at this particular time?
Yeah, I guess it goes back a long way because I've got a long history of involvement in the LNG industry in Japan. So I lived in Tokyo for 3 years in the 1990s. And then more recently, I went there a lot while I was heading the marketing team in Australia LNG in the early 2010s. Then I was struck in October 2020 by the then Japanese Prime Minister Suga made the announcement that the country would target net zero by 2050. And having been working on the energy transition, it really struck me that net zero is a huge ambition for many countries. But for Japan, it would be particularly difficult. And just as an aside, it's probably a similar situation for other places in the world, particularly South Korea, the other LNG importer nearby. The other thing that triggered it, I suppose, was in parallel, the Japanese government, METI, the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry, they were working on the basic energy plan, setting out how they see a path to 2030 and beyond. So it was quite timely to then do this research in parallel to that. The title has implications for GAS in it, because we're part of the GAS programme, but also Japan is very important for the global LNG industry. And so it seemed important to lead to a consideration of the implications for GAS. I should also say at this point that we had very useful input from our sponsors and stakeholders in Japan. And in particular, about halfway through the process, we ran a really useful workshop where we shared some initial findings and got views back from our Japanese stakeholders.
Yeah, actually, Martin, I participated in that workshop. It was very useful, and thank you from me also to our sponsors and stakeholders, and indeed other companies who've assisted us as well. Well, look, you know, one of the things you've said in your introductory remarks is, you know, it could be particularly difficult for Japan to decarbonize. So I just wanted to ask you, why do you say that?
Well, I suppose a bit of background on the Japanese energy situation would help. Japan's got very limited indigenous energy resources. And so for many, many decades, it's relied on imported sources of energy. I mean, some listeners, and I guess you and I know well, that one of the drivers for Japan starting LNG imports in a big way was a desire to diversify away from Middle Eastern oil, particularly out of the oil shocks in the 1970s. That lack of indigenous energy was also a driver for Japan to invest in nuclear power. And so in 2010, looking back at the data, nuclear power was making up 15% of Japan's primary energy. So that's 15% of total primary energy. In terms of power generation, it was 25%. So in 2010, nuclear was a pretty big deal. Then, as everyone knows, in 2011 came the very unfortunate Fukushima accident. And after that, Japan's really struggled to restart its nuclear fleet. And so that 25% of power generation in 2010, well, by 2015, nuclear was less than 1% of total power generation. It's crept back a bit since then, now around 6 or 7%. But yeah, that's a very valuable low-carbon source of fuel that's currently missing. I mean, the other plank then for decarbonisation, I guess, is renewables. And Japan's been doing pretty well in solar power since 2010, and it's been growing by about 5 gigawatts of capacity per year. And so it's now about 60 gigawatts by 2020. And maybe about 10% of total power generation. But wind power, by contrast, and in contrast to other countries, has been very slow to take off. And so there's only 4 gigawatts operational, so a very, very small amount. Then if you pull all that together, look at CO2 emissions. And so Japan tends to use 2013 as a baseline, because that was kind of the peak after the Fukushima accident, a lot more coal and gas being used. And total emissions then were around 1,200 million tonnes a year of CO2. That had dropped a bit to about 1,000 by 2019. But then Prime Minister Suga, after his net zero announcement in April this year, he said, oh, by 2030, we want to get to a 46% reduction from those 2013 levels. That would mean 680 million tonnes. So a very big drop from the 1,000 we're at today. So a big ambition to get to by 2030. And actually, it's pretty hard to see how that could be achieved.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm beginning to understand why the paper is so timely at this particular moment in time. But before we move on to ways in which Japan could start to decarbonize at scale, could you just perhaps share with our listeners, you know, the split of Japan's power generation? How's that made up?
Yeah, so I mentioned nuclear and solar already. So, and then following Fukushima, nuclear is down at about 7%. Solar's round about the same. So the big items are really LNG and coal. So LNG is probably around 35% of total generation. Coal is probably slightly less, about 31%. And there's also 8% of hydro. So that's fairly significant, Japan being quite a mountainous country. And then the other 10% is sort of other bits and pieces. Maybe just as one other comment on the current power generation mix. I talk about LNG and coal as being the big items. LNG plants run at about 55% capacity factor, so 55% of the time, whereas coal plants run much higher, around 75%. So some people argue that there could be some reduction in CO2 by some coal to gas switching. It wouldn't be huge, but I guess that would help a bit. So on a pathway to reducing emissions, some increase in LNG and some reduction in coal could help.
It's interesting, Martin, you raised the point about topography. You know, that's always been a challenge within Japan, hasn't it, on actually developing infrastructure. But why do we now move and talk about ways in which Japan could start to decarbonize at scale, okay? So why do we start with the sensitive subject of nuclear? Now, you mentioned this earlier as being, you know, an important part of the energy mix, really pre-2011. So can you perhaps tell us, you know, what could be the future for nuclear then?
Sure. So nuclear clearly, if you want to decarbonize, nuclear clearly is an important part of the solution. And indeed, the METI plan, which interestingly only has one scenario, but that scenario relies heavily on restarting all of the nuclear capacity, which theoretically could restart. So that's about 33 gigawatts of nuclear. And that would mean 36 reactors restarting, but at best only 10 have restarted so far. So that leaves really a lot of uncertainty about, because we're now 10 years on from Fukushima, and 10 years on we've managed to restart 10 reactors. So in the next 8 years, is it really realistic that we can restart the other 26 reactors or so? So nuclear, I mean, in an ideal world, more nuclear would be great. Whether it's feasible remains to be seen.
Yeah, and as you insinuated, you know, it creates a huge uncertainty when you start looking at kind of forward energy forecasts. So let's move on to address two renewables that are, of course, very important in the European energy mix, that is solar and wind. Can you tell us how important they are in the Japan energy mix?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned before, solar already is quite an important part of the mix and generates around, say, 10%, 100 terawatt hours of the total power generation. But there are estimates that the potential for solar could be as high as 500 terawatt hours, so five times where we are today. But of course, Japan being quite a small and crowded country, getting land is a bit of a challenge, needs government incentives, local approvals for it to happen. So solar can expand further. government needs to help it do that. Then for wind, you asked about as well. And I mentioned wind before, so it's been very slow to get going in Japan. Partly too, that's the sort of not in my backyard in a crowded country. You don't want to have wind turbines on mountain tops and that sort of thing. But offshore wind, some estimates have a huge potential for that, about 1,500 terawatt hours, which is huge, and then plus another 450 or so for onshore wind. But for offshore wind in particular, there are quite a lot of issues. One is, because of geography, you get into deep water quite fast, not far offshore Japan. And so it's probably a floating wind solution in many cases. So some fixed wind, but some floating wind as well. And floating wind is sort of new technology and quite expensive. Also, I think an important aspect is fishing. So fishermen have quite a lot of local power in Japan under a system of common fishery rights. And doing anything offshore, you need to get buy-in from the fisher folk. And so that can lead quite long lead times. But having said that, the Japanese government does see the point of wind. There are a few auctions now getting underway. So I think over the next, between now and 2030, we could see some significant increase in wind power.
Okay, so let's move on to another source of energy, that's geothermal, which of course is already large in Japan. What is the upside to geothermal then?
Well, so geothermal is kind of large in Japan, sort of from a tourist point of view. I mean, anyone who's visited Japan has probably been to an onsen and Japanese hot spa, and that's actually the main use currently of geothermal. Well, although it does have some power generation as well, around about 500 megawatts operational. But if you look at global picture, so the US and Indonesia are sort of numbers one and two for geothermal resource, but Japan is number three in the world with 23 gigawatts of potential. And so 23 gigawatts potential, 500 megawatts operational, there's clearly more that could be done. And it's not going to be solving the problem. So wind could be really big. Geothermal will never be that big, but it could really help, not least because it's a dispatchable source of power generation. So, you could easily get to around 3 to 5 gigawatts of geothermal. In places like the US, Iceland, Philippines, they've shown how it can be done. So further growth potential there, but never going to be huge.
Okay, now going back to the use of hydrocarbons, also the continued use of hydrocarbons, many countries, of course, are considering the use of CCS to enable this. What's happening in Japan with CCS then?
That was really interesting, because I think that was one of my biggest surprises from doing the research. I thought before I started that being an earthquake-prone country, CCS wouldn't be feasible. Because you think they have an earthquake, the risk the captured CO2 would release. But then I discovered there'd already been a demonstration project, the Tomakomai demonstration project, which had stored successfully 100,000 tonnes a year for 3 or 4 years, and now has been monitored to check that it stays there. There's also a geological survey which showed that there's potential for over 100 billion tonnes of CO2, that's over 100 years of current emissions, to be stored not far offshore. And already there are various seismic studies, so looking at the geology, done on certain particular sites. So it's early days yet, but it struck me, so I went from thinking CCS was a non-starter to actually could be quite significant. And of course, for using LNG in the future, that could become very important if LNG is imported, the carbon's captured and then stored.
Well, Martin, why don't we kind of close this subject of exploring different options by talking about a subject close to your heart, because, of course, you are heading up the hydrogen research program here at the Institute, and that is the issue, so the topic of hydrogen and ammonia. So perhaps you could kind of give us some insights as to how that could fit in with the Japan energy mix.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, hydrogen and ammonia, they're seen by many in Japan as being a very important part of the future energy mix. And indeed, the METI plan for 2030 is already talking about having 1% of power generation coming from co-firing of ammonia and hydrogen. So the idea is that ammonia could be co-fired with coal and maybe hydrogen co-fired with LNG, and so gradually you reduce the carbon footprint. I think probably ammonia is the more interesting of the two. There's already been a demonstration of co-firing of ammonia in a coal plant, and so that was by Chugoku Electric, and JERA is planning some expansion of that ammonia co-firing in the coming years. So early days yet, but the idea of making ammonia somewhere like Australia or the Middle East, importing it into Japan and then using it as a source of power generation is quite groundbreaking, but could become quite exciting perhaps.
Well, now let's pull all that together, because in your paper you've developed some scenarios for what the future might look like. Can you perhaps share with our listeners about what these look like?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first caveat is to say that the scenarios are not forecasts, but they're just pictures of what could plausibly happen. Also, for this paper, we focused on the power sector because that really is the most important sector for gas using, getting on for 2/3 of LNG imported into Japan goes into the power sector. So we came up with two scenarios, which we called rapid renewables and nuclear rebirth. And then we then compared those to METI's basic energy plan, which, as I mentioned, it came out in draft form while we were working on the paper. And then it was approved just around the time we were publishing it in October this year. But not much changed for the METI plan between the draft and the final version. So for our two scenarios, rapid renewables and nuclear rebirth, the names are quite descriptive. So in rapid renewables, we assume that wind and solar would grow as rapidly as possible to meet 170 gigawatts of solar by 2040 and 100 gigawatts of wind by the same time. I mean, that would certainly be challenging, but not impossible. I mean, as a parallel, perhaps, you think the UK is looking to add 30 gigawatts of offshore wind between now and 2030. So Japan will need to start moving pretty fast, but it could be done. In nuclear rebirth, we assume that all of the existing nuclear plants, which are on the list to restart, would restart by 2030. And then going beyond that, we assumed that there would be some new nuclear, probably often talked about small modular reactors, by 2040. So nuclear gets back to be an important part by 2030 and then grows beyond that. Then in both cases, so the government made statements about wanting to phase out inefficient coal, and it hasn't been very clear what inefficient coal means, but we halved the coal capacity by 2030 and then dropped it further thereafter in both of the scenarios. And then in both scenarios for gas, it was acting as the balancing fuel. So we left the capacity as it is today, but it was operating at a lower but variable capacity factor to make supply and demand balance.
Okay, well, look, and I assume that obviously that all fits in with the COP26 announcements that were made with kind of the reducing of coal usage in the energy mix, yeah?
It does, although, of course, notably Japan wasn't really a supporter of reducing coal. Because coal is a very important part of the diversity, and Japan is focused on security of supply, and a variety of sources is good for that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and you and I have been working, as you said earlier on, in Japan for many, many years, and one of the key messages always is the importance of security of supply to maintain the economic growth in the country of energy. Well, look, that's a great scenario. It's really interesting. Now a difficult question. How did those scenarios compare with the METI ones?
Well, so just to be clear, so METI only had one scenario rather than two or multiple scenarios. And theirs was quite close to my nuclear rebirth one. But actually, you know, as I worked on the nuclear rebirth scenario and looked at the METI plan, it's really very hard to see how that's going to happen. I mean, another important difference, though, between the METI scenario and ours was around the assumption of what happens to power demand. Because generally, in a decarbonisation scenario, it's assumed that the amount of electrification will increase. And on the other hand, there's also some energy efficiency, which could push down total energy demand. But you think with more electric vehicles, more heat pumps for heating buildings, and in fact, indeed, based on previous Japanese government forecasts, increasing power demand looked like it was going to be happening. But perhaps oddly, the METI plan assumes that total power demand by 2030 is down about 8% from today. It didn't really explain how it's going to happen. So there's a bit of suspicion that in order to get to the 46% reduction in emissions, there's a bit of target seeking going on, perhaps.
Okay, so therefore, let's get back to the crux of it. What are the implications for gas?
So I think I said that in my scenarios, gas was the balancing fuel, and that looks likely to be the case. And so the key thing is increased uncertainty. That goes, I guess, for two levels of that uncertainty. One is in the short term, that if gas is balancing intermittent renewables, it won't be clear which month, which week gas demand will get called on. So it'll be quite a lot harder for LNG cargoes to be scheduled a long time in advance. I mean, for a long time, the LNG industry has had these annual delivery programs and cargoes come in regularly. That will get a lot more flexible, I suspect. Also, for the long term, it'll be a lot harder, I think, to make long-term commitments, because if nuclear does come back, then gas won't be needed. If it doesn't come back, it will be needed. So I think overall a trend to much more flexible contracts and more spot and short term, and probably continuing price volatility like we're seeing at the moment. I guess also as an aside, city gas demand we didn't look at in detail, but we have assumed it will decline gradually with that trend towards more electrification and more households moving away from gas and installing more heat pumps.
Well, Martin, well, you know, as I think you know, I always like to end my podcast with a kind of forward-looking question. So perhaps even more difficult question, you know, what's the way forward from here then?
Well, and it's probably particularly difficult at the moment because we now have a new Prime Minister in Japan, so Prime Minister Kishida, and he had the election back at the end of October. And different commentators have different views, I think, on what he is going to do. So is he and people point out he hasn't actually restated the former Prime Minister's net zero pledges yet, although he has reiterated the 46% by 2030 target. Also, and perhaps a different approach, he's looked at pledging money to help decarbonisation in Asia. So I think there is some feeling in Japan that to get to net zero, they could count credits from helping other Asian nations decarbonize. So what actually happens in Japan, how fast they get to build wind power, how much solar is rolled out, how much nuclear comes back, all of those things are pretty uncertain. But I guess over the next sort of 8 years, we're now in 2030, it will become much clearer about what really can be achieved.
Well, look, Martin, you know, thank you so much for your time today. As always, you know, I've really enjoyed our conversation on a part of the world that's, as you know, very close to my heart. And it certainly builds on the messages from the Institute's recently published paper, Energy Transition in Japan and Implications for Gas. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.